Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will the world look like at the end of this century? Years ago, that question made us picture flying cars and other miraculous technologies. But today, an increasing number of scientists, urban planners, and political leaders are thinking instead about flooded streets and buildings and disappearing coastlines. The problem, of course, is climate-driven sea level rise. The world's oceans are already 8 inches higher than they were a century ago, and continued glacial melting and thermal expansion could mean oceans are another 3 feet higher by the year 2100. Journalist Tim Folger wrote the cover story for the September issue of National Geographic. It's called Rising Seas and features photography by George Steinmetz. You can see some of the photographs from that story in a slideshow at keranews.org. And we want to welcome Tim Folger to the show. Tim, welcome.
Oh, hi, Chris. Thanks very much.
So you open the story with a reminder of how very bad things were last year during Superstorm Sandy. And a lot of residents chose not to evacuate because they had never experienced storm surges like the ones that came with Sandy.
That's right. Sandy set a record for storm surges. 14 feet was the storm surge measured at Battery Park on the tip of Manhattan. And many residents stayed put because they sat through a bad storm the previous year and thought they could sit through this one without seeing much harm. But Sandy was much worse than that previous storm and much worse than anyone expected. And the really tragic thing is that we'll probably see storm surges like Sandy's become more frequent in the decades ahead.
Yeah, what was once sort of a once-in-a-lifetime event could happen once every 10, 12 years, possibly.
That seems likely with, as you said, you know, sea level has increased by about 8 inches over the last century, and it's expected, most scientists now believe, will increase probably by at least 3 feet, and there's a chance that sea levels might be 6 feet higher by the end of the century. So by, you know, in the days that our grandchildren will live to see, storm surges like Sandy may occur, you know, once a decade or perhaps even more frequently by the century's end.
So I actually spent my early childhood in that part of the country, and I have friends who were affected, who moved out, who have rebuilt. Is it safe for people to go back to these places, or do we need to start thinking about relocating homes and businesses that are in flood-prone areas?
Yeah, I think it really is time, especially in these very vulnerable coastal areas, to start thinking about retreating. Not many people want to do that, of course. You know, we have attachments to our homes, but there will come a point when we don't have much choice. Homeowners have been offered pre-storm buyout figures for homes, but not very many people are taking advantage of those offers yet. But as I said, there will come a time when there won't be much choice, and there will have to be incentives to encourage people to leave their homes, and those incentives might eventually come in the form of decreasing buyout offers as time goes by. Like if you miss out on a buyout offer in 1 year, the buyout offer the next year will be less. So I think policies like that will be seen, you know, in a few decades.
So, Tim, as you know, we're pretty landlocked here in North Texas. Can you tell us a little bit about storm surges, what they are, and how their severity can relate to rising sea levels?
Yeah, storm surges are basically just a large amount of water that the winds associated with the storm push ashore. And those wind-driven quantities of water basically are riding in on top of normal sea level or normal high tide. So if a high tide is higher than usual, the storm surge can be worse, as was the case with Sandy. There was an unusually high tide. And then sea level, of course, if you have a sea level that's 8 inches higher than it was a century ago, the storm surge will be much worse than it otherwise would have been.
How do scientists measure the changes in sea level over time?
There are a few different ways. In starting in the 1880s, I think that's about as far as, maybe even a bit earlier, there are pretty accurate tide gauge measurements from around the world, just measuring, you know, what the high tides are in various harbors. And then starting in the early 1990s, scientists have been able to use very accurate satellite measurements of sea level rise and also to measure the rate at which ice is disappearing from Greenland and Antarctica.
So over the past century, we've seen an eight-inch rise in sea levels and a 1 degree rise in the Earth's temperature.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So what is the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere today?
Oh, we just reached a milestone this past May. The concentration of carbon dioxide reached 400 parts per million, which we haven't seen on Earth probably in about 3 million years. Mm. When, the world was a different place then. Sea levels were about 65 feet higher. And that's really a frightening thing to contemplate, because now that we've already put this amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it's going to stay there for a long time. No matter, even if we stopped emitting all carbon dioxide tomorrow, the amount of carbon dioxide we've already put in the atmosphere will stay there for centuries and will continue to warm the Earth. And looking back 3 million years ago, the last time CO2 levels were this high, and to realize that sea levels were 65 feet higher, that might be what we're in for in the long term. Hmm. So it's no matter what we do now in terms of reducing our carbon dioxide emissions, we're kind of locked into really a serious amount of sea level rise in the centuries ahead.
65 feet higher. If we were looking at anything like that, I mean, how much of what is now land would in fact be under the ocean?
Oh, in the current edition of National Geographic, they have a great fold-out map. It's like a 5-page fold-out map that shows what the world will look like if all the world's ice melted, if all the world's ice melted, sea levels would rise. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates by about 216 feet. Mm. And it's just really an utterly different planet. You see inland seas in Western Asia, an enormous inlet, in between Texas and Louisiana. The cover of National Geographic shows the Statue of Liberty, and there's a water line across the Statue of Liberty, and in kind of faint print on the cover, it says no ice. So that's a sea level rise of 216 feet up the Statue of Liberty's body that you see on the cover of the magazine.
So essentially in that scenario, and I'm looking here at this map, which is really, really well done, New York underwater, Boston underwater, Charleston, all of Florida underwater, all of New Orleans underwater, Houston underwater, as well as a significant chunk of Texas and Mexico. We would be looking at really a stunning shift in populations in addition to loss of landmass.
An enormous shift in population. And again, this map is showing an ice-free world, which is not something we're going to see for quite a while. It might take 3,000, 5,000 years for that to happen. But if we continue along our present path, that's the sort of world we'll shape. And you're right, it will involve enormous shifts in population. Entire countries will have to move. It will be unprecedented. And that's why many climate scientists are beginning to say, the climate change, sea level rise, they really are presenting threats to civilization. Can we handle such enormous population shifts? We've never had to contend with anything like that in our history, and it's not clear that civilization could, withstand such stresses. And that sea level rise will just be one of many of the problems that climate change will present us with. Of course, drought, as you know, in Texas, and wildfires, water shortages. We're going to have a number of challenges in the centuries ahead that we'll have to confront. And it's a race we haven't even entered yet. So we can't even really say we're losing the race, because we haven't entered it yet.
Yeah.
It's,
uh, We're slow to the starting line, essentially.
Tragically slow.
Well, Tim, when you talk about water shortages, this is it's very interesting in a sort of terrifying way. There will be more liquid water on the planet than there has been in the course of human history. But the problem is much of it will be sort of contaminated with salt water. So it's not going to be instantly potable.
That's right. Florida is already facing that problem of saltwater encroachment. And then, as I said, there will be larger parts of the world subject to drought, desertification. The spread of deserts will increase. There's a lot of fresh water on the planet. I think it's something like 5 million cubic miles of ice of fresh water we have. But unfortunately, a lot of that will present a problem in terms of rising sea levels as it seeps into the ocean year after year, rather than into farmland or into our reservoirs.
So figuring out just how this will all play out has been a challenge. Tell us a little bit about how climate scientists have begun to amend their predictions about sea level rise just in recent years.
Yeah, it's really interesting. If anything, the scientists' predictions over the years have repeatedly proven to be too conservative. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, which is a UN body that periodically assesses the state of the world's climate science. Their last report predicted about a 23-inch rise in sea level as being the high end of what we might expect by the end of the century. And that report was just released in 2007. So their new report, which is due out at the end of this year, is predicting, there was a leaked version of the report that came out, and they're predicting, again, as most scientists now, predicting about 3 feet rise in sea level by the end of this year. So the predictions have really been overturned as being too conservative in the past, and I think we'll probably continue to see that.
And ice sheets are actually melting at a faster rate, that the melt rate is accelerating?
The melt rate is accelerating. The Arctic ice decreased at a rate of about 4% per decade from 1979 to 2012. Sea level rose from 1901 to 2010 at about 1.7 millimeters per year. And just between 1993 and 2010, the increase in sea level was almost doubled from 3.2 millimeters per year from 1993 to 2010, compared with 1.7 millimeters from 1901 to 2010.
My guest is journalist Tim Folger. He wrote the cover story for the September issue of National Geographic magazine. It's called Rising Seas. You can see images from that story in a slideshow at keranews.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Tim Folger. He's a contributing editor at Discovery, and he wrote the cover story for the September issue of National Geographic magazine. It's called Rising Seas. If you'd like to see a slideshow of images from that story, you can go to the keranews.org page and find that there. If you want to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And Tim, that's where we hear from listener Larray, who asks if you could talk about positive feedback loops and how they're related to the collective carbon load.
That might be a bit beyond my expertise. Positive feedback loops in terms of the more carbon we add to the atmosphere, the warmer the planet will get. If we continue business as usual, I'm not sure if this will be answering the listener's question, but if we continue with business as usual in terms of emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we'll likely reach 1,000 parts per million concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere by the end of the century, and that would be a catastrophic level. The Earth hasn't seen that level since something like 30 million years ago, when there were crocodiles in what is now Antarctica. The Earth was completely ice-free, and that would set the stage for an ice-free planet.
And am I correct that none of the freeze and thaw cycles that we have seen naturally over the 4 billion years of history this planet has seen, none of them has happened quite this quickly?
No. We're seeing record after record overturned on a regular basis. And that recently leaked IPCC report, I'm just looking on my computer right now, said that the past 30 years were very likely the warmest 30-year period in the last 800 years.
Okay, so you described the melting of the Thwaites Glacier in western Antarctica as one of the biggest wild cards in all of these calculations regarding what we are likely to see over the next century. What variables make those calculations so complicated for scientists?
Well, it's largely that scientists don't understand the physics of how ice fractures, how easily does it break apart. As you can imagine, studying something like that would be enormously difficult. So no one really knows how fast the ice will melt. Will there be a sudden release of ice at the Thwaites Glacier? Will it be a gradual release of its meltwater? No one really knows. I spoke with one scientist, and he said it's unlikely that the Thwaites Glacier will collapse into the sea by the end of the century. But he said if he was really being held accountable for something, he had to point out that you couldn't rule out the complete collapse of the Thwaites ice sheet, which, if that did happen, would add another 9 meters or, 25-plus feet of water to the, or 25 feet plus of sea level rise.
So at this point, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is recommending that planners design for more than 6 feet of sea level rise. And this is planners looking at, say, municipal infrastructure, that sort of thing.
That's right. Six feet is probably a safe figure for this century. And not too many cities are prepared to deal with that. Just a couple of months ago, Mayor Bloomberg in New York City announced a very ambitious and far-sighted plan for the city to cope with the sorts of sea level changes we could expect for the rest of the century. And you can only hope that his successors will follow up on his recommendations. But as far as American cities go, New York is kind of ahead of the pack, and most other coastal cities haven't really begun to confront the problem yet.
And there are a number of options that might be available to people wanting to make changes. There are things as sort of simple but also unsightly as putting in literal floodgates around vulnerable areas.
And that's right. Mayor Bloomberg has proposed that New York have movable barriers put in place that could be put up or down in advance of a storm. There have been very much more ambitious sorts of barriers proposed, you know, such as a permanent storm surge barrier that would cover the entire New York Harbor, from going from New Jersey to the tip of Long Island. A project like that would, you know, cost maybe somewhere between $10, $15, $20 billion. But Sandy alone caused New York City nearly $20 billion in damage. So there are many people who advocate building a large barrier like that. Many countries around the world have already built such barriers. Russia has barriers around St. Petersburg, and the Netherlands, of course, has many such barriers that protect their cities.
Yeah, it seems that Dutch engineers are very much in demand around the world these days.
They are, and they've been advising the United States and the Bloomberg administration. They've one Dutch firm has consulted on building a large barrier in New York Harbor, a number of large barriers in New York Harbor. The Dutch have also helped build a barrier that protected New Orleans from Hurricane Isaac last summer, which would have devastated the city had that barrier not been in place.
And I love that element of the story, because you were speaking to the engineer who was associated with the project, and he said, you didn't hear much about that? It's because it worked.
Exactly, yes. And when I was sitting with him over dinner, I said, yeah, you're right. I didn't hear about that. So.
Well, you actually went to the Netherlands, and specifically you spent a lot of time in and around Rotterdam. And some of the infrastructure that's been built there seems to be sort of, it appears to be organic, even though it's got a very important functional design to it.
You're right. It's really remarkable in that most people in the Netherlands really don't even think about the fact that they might be living below sea level. 26% of the country lies below sea level, and I think very few people there even think about the threat from the sea now, because their defensive measures are so well integrated into the landscape. I mentioned in the story how I was walking around Rotterdam one February afternoon, and with a city official who was showing me some of the protective measures the city has built over the decades. And we were walking up a hill at one point, and I didn't think anything of it, but the city official said, you know, we're walking up the side of a dike right now. And it was quite a large dike, and on top of the dike was a typical Dutch street, you know, everybody on their bicycles, and there were shops and stores and homes along the top of the dike. But this was a huge dike that was integral to protecting Rotterdam.
Of course, none of this happens overnight. This was a 40-year initiative by the government of the Netherlands.
Yes, it was the result of a catastrophic storm that hit the Netherlands in 1953 that killed more than 1,800 people. And after that storm, the Dutch initiated the world's most ambitious, you know, flood control and sea storm protection program in the world, building barriers, thousands of miles of dikes. And the last component of that plan was only finished in 1997, so it was very far-sighted, and the Dutch have been really reaped the benefits of that over the decades. And that one storm from 1953 really showed that for the Dutch, people weren't thinking about climate change in those days, but such storms for the Dutch were a matter of national security, and that's going to become increasingly an issue for many countries around the world. Protecting against sea level rise will be a matter of national security.
And even things like building designs, parking garages, the way sidewalks are set up, of course, they work for, you know, the reason that the building is constructed, but they also have sort of redundant flood control measures.
Yes, there are parking garages that were designed to hold flood water in the Netherlands. I was walking down a tiered sidewalk in the middle of Rotterdam that was designed to channel flood water. Well, you could still walk on an elevated sidewalk above, but when I saw it, it just looked like a very pleasant open plaza with sculptures along the area that would be flooded.
Tim, was there resistance there initially when these measures were undertaken and these very, very expensive projects were proposed?
You know, I imagine that's a good question. I imagine there must have been the usual political haggling about expenses, but I think the extent of that tragedy in 1953 was so great. There were so many lives lost. Nearly everyone in the Netherlands probably knew someone who was affected by the tragedy, because just such a large part of the southern part of the country was just completely inundated. I think there was a lot of national unity behind the measures. And the Dutch are still working. The Dutch know, of course, that their battle isn't over. They're planning a new round of projects. They call it Delta Works 2, that first post-1953 series of public works projects was collectively known as Delta Works. So they're thinking about Delta Works 2 now, which would safeguard the country for the rest of this century. And the Dutch are really ahead of the rest of the world. They build to much higher standards of protection than we do. They've estimated that they could probably afford to protect their country against as much as 5 meters or 16 feet of sea level rise, which would probably safeguard them well into the next century.
And they are sort of adopting the idea that you have to ultimately work with water rather than against it, recognize, the inherent properties of water. And some of the ways that they're working with water is by using it to their advantage. Can you talk about this project called the Zand Motor?
Oh, yes. That's kind of like a super ambitious dredging project where they're protecting their coast by... The Netherlands has the luxury of having these enormous offshore deposits of sand that were left there, as glaciers melted and retreated at the end of the last ice age. So what the sand motor is a huge dredging project where the Dutch, instead of building up a coast by depositing sand year by year, the Dutch have dredged enough sand and deposited on one part of their coast that represents probably about 20 years worth of dredging. And the idea is that this enormous quantity of sand, which covers about, I think it's about 250 football fields worth of area, is that the natural action of the tides and the wind and onshore waves will sweep that sand along the coast and help build up the coast and dunes. And you can already see that it seems to be working. There are small dunes growing in areas that just a couple of years ago were open water. And it's probably a much more cost-effective way of protecting their coast than, reinforcing dikes or, building another barrier. It's easier to dredge and deposit sand than it is to build a $15 billion storm surge barrier.
Yeah, and I guess you can do it to less exacting standards and still have it be pretty effective.
That's right, and they can adjust the amount of sand. If sea level rise seems to be occurring faster than scientists predicted, the Dutch can just add more sand. But as I said, the Dutch have that luxury of having a lot of sand offshore. Northeast United States also has a lot of offshore sand deposits, so a similar approach might work there. But say someplace like Florida doesn't have a lot of sand. In fact, they have a shortage of sand in Florida. An approach like that wouldn't work. And that's one of the interesting things I learned while reporting on this story, is that sort of the Dutch-style solutions won't work everywhere. Each country, each city within each country will be faced with a unique set of challenges.
I forget exactly how much water, and if you can't remember offhand, it's fine. But it's not that strange to think that Miami could be left an island by changes that are coming within the next several decades.
Yes, it's really shocking, and it's hard to believe. And just for me as a journalist, when a scientist would tell me that, he said, this geologist that I spoke with at the University of the University of Florida? Excuse me, right now I'm forgetting. One scientist told me that by the end of the century, he would be surprised, is the way he put it, if many people were still living in southeastern Florida, as you said, by the end of the century, or certainly by sometime in the next century, Miami will be an island, and at some point, Miami will be underwater. But Florida, well before Miami becomes an island, Florida will be facing, you know, the issues that we talked about earlier. People will have to relocate from the coast.
But talk about this. You know, I was in Florida last summer, and people are still building houses along the beach. They're still building businesses. Is anyone talking seriously about limiting coastline development in places that are sure to be affected by global sea rise?
It's an issue, but I think the developers at this point are winning. I don't think there is any hint of a slowdown in development in coastal areas in Florida or pretty much anywhere else in the country. Development's continuing apace, and it's going to be, especially Florida, they face really insurmountable problems. I think it's inevitable that, you know, large parts of southeastern Florida especially will have to be abandoned by the end of the century.
And you write here, the day could come, maybe if not in our lifetimes, our children's or our grandchildren's, when waterfront property is the very cheapest stuff you can find.
That's right. Yeah. Can you imagine now in coastal New England or New York City, or if you'd like right now, if you want to, you know, like a condo and on the Hudson River or the East River, that would command a premium. But a century from now, when the city has retreated to the, you know, higher parts of New York's boroughs, the high ground will be at a premium, and those coastal areas will. Maybe there will be some industries there that will be have to be relocated. We're just facing large scale abandonment of low lying areas, and you're right there.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. My guest is journalist Tim Folger. He wrote the cover story for the National Geographic magazine in September. The story is called "Rising Seas." Back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Tim Folger. He's a contributing editor at Discovery, and he wrote the cover story for the September issue of National Geographic magazine. It's called "Rising Seas." If you'd like to see slides from that story, you can go to keranews.org. If you want to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Tim, when we think about back to Florida again, so there's not a lot of sand off the coast that could be used to create something like the Zand Motor being used in the Netherlands. There's also the issue that Florida essentially sits on a bed of limestone, which is very porous.
Yes, that was kind of shocking for me to learn when I was speaking with one scientist there. I asked him about whether Dutch-style barriers could help protect Florida, and he disappeared from his office for a few seconds and came back, and he had this sample of limestone, which looked to me like a kind of a piece of petrified Swiss cheese. It's all of Florida, or most of southern Florida, rests on a foundation of this very porous limestone that water just seeps right through. And even if engineers built huge barriers to protect Miami, or even if they walled off all of southern Florida, seawater would still be flooding the state from underneath because the bedrock beneath the state is so porous.
And currently all over the world, some of the very biggest cities that we have, most of the very biggest cities that we have, are on the ocean.
The port cities are integral to the world's economy. You just think about you know, Ho Chi Minh City in our own country, you know, of course, New York and New Orleans. These, you know, and port cities, coastal cities, they attract people. People want to live near the coast. It's beautiful. Cities provide job opportunities, but these assets are going to be jeopardized with each coming decade. The Office of Economic Cooperation and Development estimated that by 2070, about 150 of the world's largest port cities will be at risk, with 34 trillion dollars, I think, was the figure I mentioned in the National Geographic article, would be the size of the assets endangered by sea level rise by 2070, which at that time will be nearly 10% of the world's GDP. And that's using a fairly conservative estimate for sea level rise. I think was less than 2 feet was the number that was used for those projections.
And then you have places like the Maldives, where it is so flat and surrounded by so much water that a lot of people think that it simply will not exist in the future.
Yeah, certainly, the Maldives will be gone, and. And the harder thing, of course, to get your mind around is the world's largest cities will someday be submerged. Maybe, you know, certainly not in our lifetimes, not in our children's lifetimes, but within a few centuries, how do you get your mind around the idea that that London won't be there or New York won't be there? It's, you know, when scientists are telling you these things, you almost hesitate to report them because they seem sensationalistic. And I think scientists have hesitated to make such, to make such predictions. But, you know, given that we're really not doing much to slow the rate of global warming, it seems like that's our most likely future, a world where there won't be a Maldives, there won't be a London, there won't be a New York, at least not in its current location.
And even in 2100, which is, you know, at least in our grandchildren's lifetimes, there may not be a Wall Street.
There may not be a Wall Street, or it may be a very Venice-like Wall Street, subject to periodic flooding, elevated sidewalks. New York is wealthy enough that it might be able to cope in an adaptive way with sea level rise. You know, as you mentioned earlier, the Dutch are looking into ways of living with water. And I think New York, at least in the near term, will probably be able to do the same thing, making allowances for periodic flooding, raising buildings so that generators won't be flooded, making their foundations withstand rot and mold. But New York is probably wealthy enough to adapt, but many of the world cities won't be wealthy enough to adapt.
We have an email here from Paul in Dallas, and I'm not sure if this is something that you looked into, but Paul asks, to what extent will the addition of fresh water from ice melt change the ocean currents, and will those changes slow or accelerate global warming?
No, I didn't look into that. It's an interesting question to explore. I wish I had an easy answer for that, but I don't.
Talk about this, because you explain it nicely in the piece. There are actually two reasons why the sea levels are rising as the planet warms. One is melting glacial ice, and I think people understand that. But another is that the volume of water expands as it warms up.
Yes, that's simple physics that we all can witness that. And just when you heat something, its volume expands a little bit. And the same is true of the world's oceans. And I was startled to learn that thermal expansion alone accounts for about of the one third of sea level rise that we've seen to date. In the future, though, ice melt will increasingly dominate the sea level rise.
To what extent are efforts to prepare ourselves for what is coming, do they tend to be sort of municipal issues, or are federal governments around the world taking the lead on these projects?
Well, I believe, aside from the Netherlands, I think cities have been taking the lead. Mayor Bloomberg in New York is certainly ahead of the federal government in the United States in terms of confronting, even admitting, the sorts of problems we'll face. Cities in the Netherlands, or the Netherlands itself, has been reaching out to other cities around the world to try to work on joint ventures to help prepare some of these cities, like Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam, that doesn't have the expertise nor the resources to prepare for these changes on their own.
I wonder how much insurance companies will have to do with the way we change, how and where we settle, how and where we build. At some point, after paying out a certain number of claims, it would seem that your friendly State Farm guy is not going to issue you a policy in the same location that's been devastated before.
I think that's inevitable. Yeah, your friendly State Farm agent won't be so friendly once sea level rises, maybe 20 inches higher than it is today. Excuse me, my phone is beeping. I might have to switch to another phone. I think the battery's about to run out.
Okay, well, I will vamp a little bit while you take care of that. My guest is journalist Tim Folger. He is a contributing editor at Discovery, and he wrote the cover story for the September issue of National Geographic magazine. Are you back with us, Tim?
I'm back, Chris. I grabbed another phone, and this one's fully charged, so it should be good for a while.
Wonderful. Thank you. Okay. So when you are reporting on these issues, and I know that you've done a lot of this sort of work, I mean, do you have to struggle with your own sense of vulnerability, or that, your worry for generations that are coming ahead beyond us?
I certainly do. I worry about the future that my I have two nieces and a nephew. I worry about the sort of world they'll see. And since I've been reporting on these issues, and I realize, we're all complicit every time we take our car out of the garage, every time we flick on a light, where we unavoidably add to the problem because we all depend on fossil fuels that, when they're burned, release the gases that are warming the planet and which are rising the seas. None of us, unfortunately, can escape complicity in the problem.
Well, and it's so hard, I think, for a lot of people to make the connection, right? Because you adjust the air conditioner temperature and you take it down a couple degrees, and it's really hard to link that to the Maldives essentially sinking into the ocean. It doesn't feel like cause and effect, even though, in fact, we know that it is.
That's I think, the core of the problem. All these little things that we do I don't know if you remember that comic strip Pogo, where the character said, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." Mm-hmm. And I think that's why the problem is so difficult, that we're all involved, and it's very difficult, maybe impossible, for us as individuals to make an effective change on the problem. We really have to rely on our elected representatives to enact the policies that will at least avoid making the problem worse. As we talked about earlier, we're already inevitably locked in to a certain amount of global warming and sea level rise. The issue is, how bad are we going to let things get? Are we going to continue with business as usual so that CO2 levels reach levels not seen in 30 million years, in which case we'll have an utterly transformed planet within centuries, and maybe a planet in which our civilization may not be able to survive. So I think it's really our responsibility as citizens to be as well informed as we can be on these issues, and to elect representatives who are concerned and informed about these issues.
You know, one thing that really made me want to have this conversation on the air was that we've seen a lot of reporting about the changes we really need to make in our consumption of fossil fuels and the other ways we manage our energy. But it's clear reading a piece like this that we can no longer hope that that might be enough to protect us. We need to make those changes, but we also need to prepare for what we've already done to the planet.
That's it, and that's one of the great tragedies I think we're confronting right now, is that the time when we might have been able to prevent this tragic series of events has passed. Now we're clearly entering an era where we have to start adapting to the changes that we've already set in motion, and that's a challenge we really cannot afford to face.
When you talk to the scientists and to the designers and the professionals who are working on these problems, do many of them describe for you the sort of eureka moment that they had when they realized just how serious the problem was? Because we did see sort of a shift from people thinking this might be something to pay attention to a great deal of people within the scientific community recognizing that this is perhaps the foremost crisis of our time.
Yeah, I didn't come across too many eureka moments. It was more like a series of maybe a case of mounting frustration that despite this clear presentation of really irrefutable evidence of what's happening in the world, that there hasn't been action taken that needs to be taken yet. And we're really going to have, I think future generations will really look back and wonder, what were we thinking?
It seems also very clear that there will be a lot of not just sort of domestic migration in affected countries, but a lot of international movement to get away from vulnerable areas and to relocate to high ground.
Yes, I think we already see that happening in Bangladesh. And I think we already have some climate refugees. And just a month or so ago, I was reading about some of the ethnic violence in Myanmar, where this overwhelmingly Buddhist country, which you would normally think of as being a very peaceful place, where Buddhists are persecuting Muslims. And many of the Muslims are refugees from Bangladesh. And I didn't really pursue this as a story, but I was wondering how many of those refugees were climate refugees, because Bangladesh is a very low-lying country and one of the most vulnerable to climate change and sea level rise. And then that's just one relatively small example in the world, and you wonder what is going to happen when far larger populations have to shift. Where will they go? Even in an advanced country like the Netherlands, this one Dutch engineer who was involved in constructing the sand motor just asked me, kind of laughing, "Well, where can we go? Germany?" He said it. But the Dutch won't have to face that problem for probably another two centuries. But eventually, even the Dutch, 200 years from now, perhaps will be facing, where can they go? You can only build seawall so high.
Got to jump in here. We're out of time. Tim Folger wrote the cover story for the September issue of National Geographic. It's called Rising Seas and features photography by George Steinmetz. Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. We had help on the phones from Christina Martinez, and Lindsay Connect produced the show. You can learn more about Think and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.